This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. I'll be reading excerpts from the book The Nature of Oaks by Douglas Tallamy. This book was published in 2021 by Timber Press in Portland, Oregon. I became aware of Tallamy when his book Bringing Nature Home was published in 2007 and became quite well known. The main lesson from that book was the importance of planting native trees and shrubs, flowers and grasses, no matter how much land or backyard or even back porch that you have, in order to provide the needed host plants for our native insects, which are in such a serious decline. The myriad of non-native plants that we all favor dominate the landscape, and our native insects can't use any of the non-native plants to reproduce and to thrive. And our birds are virtually all insect eaters. Even the large predatory birds are insect eaters. Insects are a great source of protein, and all animals know it. And even some plants eat insects. But the key thing to know is that insects need native plants, trees and shrubs, grasses and forbs, for their food and shelter and young to survive. All these interrelationships are so vital. And we can really help by starting to plant native things. I'll start with the prologue of The Nature of Oaks. Tallamy takes us month by month through the ecosystem of oak trees. He gives us a glimpse into how he came to know and love oaks. On 15 July 2000, Cindy and I moved into our newly constructed house in southeastern Pennsylvania. I remember the date well because 15 July is my son's birthday, and one of his birthday presents that year was to help us carry furniture from our rental van into our new house. On one of many trips, a paper wasp stung him on the back of his head just as he passed through the front door. The wasp nest was in the upper corner of the jam, and its occupants gave my son a painful reminder that he is the tallest Tallamy on record. Our property is 10 acres, and it had been mowed for hay for decades before we bought it. Its only trees were three hickories in the upper corner of the property, a few black cherries, and two black oaks, and an occasional black walnut along an old fence line from the days the area was grazed by cattle. I was eager to plant more trees, so that fall I collected some white oak acorns and planted one in a small flower pot. I don't remember where I found that acorn, but it was probably from a large white oak that grew near the turnaround spot on the jogging walking route Cindy and I now take when the spirit moves us. Years later, we would collect bags of acorns from that tree each fall, mostly because we couldn't stand to see them crunched by cars or mowed by the homeowner. White oak acorns germinate soon after they fall to the ground, sending what will become the tree's taproot deep into the soil before the first frost. They then rest for the winter and do not produce the first green shoot until the following spring. Above ground growth is slow that first year. Only one set of true leaves is produced, and the tree remains just a few inches tall. This is a snail's pace compared to trees like American elms or sycamores, which can grow more than 2 feet in their first year, and it probably explains the general perception that oaks are slow growers. But their growth rate below ground is a different story. All the energy those first leaves gather from the sun is allocated toward root growth. In fact, after their first year, a seedling oak may have up to 10 times more root mass than the biomass of leaves and shoots above the ground. Oaks produce enormous root systems over their lifetimes, and these help make them champions when it comes to soil stabilization, carbon sequestration, and watershed management. William Bryant Logan relates the story of a group of Scandinavians who were interested in measuring the extent of the root system of Quercus robur, commonly known as the English oak or King's oak, since various kings of England protected forests of these trees for their private hunting grounds. Their approach was not high-tech. They simply started scraping the dirt away to see how far the roots extended from the trunk of the tree. After days of digging, they had exposed a root system that extended 3 times the width of the oak's canopy. And then they gave up, convinced that the roots went on forever. I'm sure they did not, but the Scandinavians' efforts clearly obliterated the myth that oak tree roots go out only as far as the crown spread. I planted my white oak in a flower pot because if I had planted straight into the ground, the chances that a vole or white-footed mouse would have dined on it somewhere over the winter was at least 99%. It's even a challenge to keep mice out of flower pots over the winter, but somehow I managed and was able to plant my tiny tree the following June. Oak seedlings are a favorite of browsing white-tailed deer, so I put a small chicken wire cage around my seedling that first year and then upgraded to a 5-foot galvanized wire cage that kept my oak safe and sound for the next 4 years. I'm sure I watered my transplant once or twice, but through serendipitous laziness, I did not fertilize the little guy. Although I didn't know it at the time, most North American trees do not need, and many in fact do not tolerate, high nitrogen fertilizers. They are adapted to grow best on the nutrient-poor soils that the last glaciation left behind in North America. This is particularly true for white oaks, which thrive on poor, shallow soils. It is now 18 years later, and that tiny seedling is nearly 45 feet tall, with a trunk circumference of 47 inches at breast height, and a canopy spread of 30 feet. Despite this impressive growth rate, my oak is still a baby. Oaks in general are long-lived trees, and members of the white oak group, as well as species in the red oak and canyon oak groups, can easily live many hundreds of years if their roots are given free rein and not impeded by sewer lines, road cuts, basements, parking lots, or some other such human constraint. During that impressive lifespan, a single tree will drop up to 3 million acorns and serve as a lifeline for countless creatures, including dozens of bird species, rodents, bears, raccoons, opossums, rat snakes, fence lizards, several butterflies, hundreds of moths, centipede gall wasps, and other predators and parasitoids, weevils, myriad spiders, and dozens more species of arthropods, mollusks, and annelids that depend on oak leaf litter for nourishment and protection. Unfortunately, the diverse web of life that is associated with oaks goes unnoticed and thus unappreciated by most homeowners and even many trained biologists. In fact, too many homeowners cut down the oaks on their properties because they've grown tired of raking leaves. The cause of this indifference is lack of knowledge. How can we be interested in or understand the ecological significance of something we know nothing about? Today, our ignorance of natural history is a cultural norm. Our attention has been usurped by the digital age, and any spare moments we have each day are consumed by our personal devices or flat-screen TVs. Our school curriculum does not fill this knowledge void, and most assignments have a digital component that teaches us little about the life around us. I meet intelligent adults today, people who have excelled at all levels of their education and are successful members of our society, who cannot even recognize an oak leaf, let alone tell me anything about the food webs linked to oaks or the many ways oaks provide the life support we call ecosystem services. Even worse, they fail to see the importance of such minimal knowledge of natural history. And that is why I've decided to write this book. My point is simply this. There is much going on in your yard that would not be going on if you didn't have one or more oak trees gracing your piece of planet Earth. But you will never know it unless you have a guide. A similar book could be written about pines or cherries or elms or birches. Every tree genus, in fact, has a unique and fascinating story to tell, but those tales will not be as impressive as the story about oaks. Oaks support more forms of life and more fascinating interactions than any other tree genus in North America. All this life does not show up at the same time, nor stay with your oak the entire year. Some species, in fact, are so ephemeral, you need to be on hand the single day they visit your tree to fully appreciate what an oak tree can bring to your yard and into your life if you're willing. We need to follow what is happening to your oak trees month by month through all four seasons. And that is how I've organized this book, a monthly hint at the many parts of nature associated with the oaks in your yard. I start with October, not because that is the most rewarding month for oak watching, although it is a good one. Rather, it was October when I decided to write this book. And now part of the October chapter. When our property was no longer mowed for hay, the invasive plants from Asia, multiflora rose, autumn olive, Japanese honeysuckle, that had been kept at bay by the mowing, exploded everywhere. These species are incapable of supporting the wildlife we hope to attract to our new home. So a typical weekend at the Talamys involved whacking out the root balls of huge multiflora rose bushes with my mattock. It was satisfying work, especially when we got to stack the whacked bodies up in giant piles, but it did leave open ground wherever we had removed a bush. The following spring, we were thrilled but somewhat befuddled to find seedling white oaks and beeches popping up in many of these disturbed areas. Befuddled because I couldn't for the life of me figure out how they had gotten there. We had no white oaks or beeches on our property and no mature trees nearby from which squirrels could have moved seeds even if they had carried them a good distance. I knew that acorns and beech nuts, unlike the seeds of many other plants, do not remain viable in the soil for more than a year, so there was no chance they had sprouted from a seed bank many years old. I was stumped. I love such ecological puzzles and blame them for all the times I walk down the hall but have no idea why I am walking down the hall. My mind is usually elsewhere. Fortunately, I hadn't puzzled over the oak seedling conundrum too long before I saw a picture in a photography magazine of a blue jay flying with an acorn in its beak. A quick literature search revealed that I had indeed stumbled on the answer. It was blue jays that were bringing acorns and beech nuts to our property and planting them for us everywhere. The soil was disturbed enough to make tapping the seeds below ground easy. Although blue jays are the only jays in much of the eastern United States, there are 8 species of jays in North America and 40-some worldwide. They all share a common ancestor that evolved about 60 million years ago in what is now Southeast Asia, the same time and place that oaks evolved. Oaks and jays are thought to have hit it off right from the start. Oaks made large, nutritious seeds that are the perfect size and shape for jays to eat. And in their attempt to store these seeds for long periods, jays became the quintessential acorn dispersers. Over the eons, jays became so dependent on oak acorns that they adapted both physically and behaviorally to acorn traits. The small hook at the pointed end of a jay's beak is designed to rip open an acorn's husk, and a jay's expanded esophagus, its gular pouch, enables it to carry up to 5 acorns at once while in flight. Just because a jay can carry more than 1 acorn at a time does not mean it takes them all to the same place. Whereas many birds cache groups of seeds for use during periods of drought or cold, jays bury them as singletons just beneath the surface of the ground at sites dispersed throughout their winter territory. These can be over a mile from the acorn-bearing tree, which makes jays the undisputed champions among acorn dispersers and explains where blue jays had found acorns to bring to our property. There are a number of large white oaks and beeches within a mile of our house. The idea, of course, is that each jay will remember all the places it has buried an acorn and then know exactly where to go to retrieve the seed for food as needed during the winter. but apparently this is more of a mental challenge than most jays are up to, and who can blame them? A single jay can gather and bury up to 4,500 acorns each fall, but it typically remembers where only a quarter of them are buried before springtime. And if a Cooper's hawk manages to eat a jay in December, that jay retrieves none of its acorns. The end result is that each jay plants somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,300 oak trees every year of its 7 to 17-year lifespan. It's no wonder the jays have enabled oaks to move about the earth faster than any other tree species. Moving acorns away from the parent tree, where they would surely lose in the competitive battle for light, nutrients, and water, provides oaks with an enormous ecological service. But oaks may derive another important benefit from their relationship with jays beyond the obvious advantages of seed dispersal. Like all organisms, oaks have always had to contend with diseases that attack them over their long lifespan. In recent decades, however, oaks have been besieged by new diseases introduced from other continents. Sudden oak death and oak wilt are two that have hit oaks hard in several areas of the country. In both cases, however, a small percentage of the oaks in natural and planned landscapes have shown some degree of resistance to these diseases. When disease hits an area, it is the resistant oaks that produce the most and best acorns, and it is jays that preferentially disperse those seeds bearing resistance genes. Although many oaks die quickly from introduced diseases, the seeds of those that remain are spread throughout the countryside by jays, assuring that future generations of oaks will be better able to survive infection. This is natural selection at its best, but only works when the partnership between oaks and jays is thriving. The white oak I planted as an acorn in our front yard produced its first acorns last year. So now the ancient co-evolved relationship between jays and oaks can play out right in our yard. Jays, of course, are not the only birds that love acorns. Acorns are a critical component of winter diets for turkeys, Lewis's woodpecker, and many ducks, especially the beautiful wood duck. And they are taken opportunistically by tufted titmice, bobwhite quails, red-bellied woodpeckers, yellow-shafted flickers, eastern towhees, American crows, and white-breasted nuthatches. For the most part, these birds eat acorns as they find them, but a notable exception is the acorn woodpecker of western oak woodlands. Acorn woodpeckers are specialists that store hundreds of acorns for winter use in individual holes they've drilled into snags. They are a colonial species that uses the same acorn storage tree year after year. A single acorn snag can accumulate 50,000 holes ready to receive acorns each fall. If you live in the West and are lucky enough to have an acorn snag within view of your house, you can cancel your subscription to Netflix. Watching your acorn woodpeckers work your tree will be entertainment enough. The list of mammals that rely on acorns for winter forage is also a long one. We all know how much gray squirrels love acorns, but so do red and flying squirrels, chipmunks, rabbits, black bears, white-tailed deer. Acorns make up as much as 75% of a white-tailed deer's diet in late fall. Opossums, raccoons, white-footed mice, and voles. And no wonder. Acorns contain large amounts of protein, carbohydrates, and fats, as well as calcium, phosphorus, potassium, and niacin. If it hadn't been for a healthy supply of acorns from various oak species, many of the animals just listed would have been devastated when American chestnuts disappeared from eastern forests after the introduction of chestnut blight from Asia. Speaking of acorns, have you ever noticed that every once in a while oaks produce an outsized crop of acorns? And it's usually not just one oak here and there, but often nearly all the oaks in an entire region that produce an extraordinary number of acorns in the same year. An exceptional example was seen in the fall of 2019 when members of the Red Oak group from Georgia through Massachusetts synchronously produced vast numbers of acorns. This phenomenon is called masting, and it has begged explanation for centuries. When I was in graduate school, I was taught that masting is an adaptation against acorn predation. Acorns are such a valuable source of food for so many types of animals that if oaks predictably produced a moderate number of acorns each year, the squirrels and deer, the mice and the jays, the ducks and the towhees, and all the other creatures that rely on acorns to get them through the winter would increase their population sizes to meet the available food supply. This would not be good news for oaks because every year, large populations of acorn eaters would end up destroying nearly every available acorn, and oak reproductive success would plummet. But if oaks unpredictably and synchronously produced many more acorns than there were acorn predators to eat them, that is, if they produced a mast, some acorns would escape the predatory scramble for acorns and germinate. I'll stop reading the October chapter here. Next week, we will delve into the November chapter and learn about some of the insects, the weevils, that rely on acorns for their life cycle. It's fascinating. I've been reading from Douglas Tallamy's book called The Nature of Oaks. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.